Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Excited to have Carrie Newhoff on the podcast today, and been a long time coming. I think I remember about 3 years ago, I went down to my friends the hallway in our church, and I said, "I'm going to be on Carrie's podcast one day," and they're like, "Whatever, you're an idiot." and I'm close. You're on mine.
This is step one.
Yes, right,
Chesley, that's great.
Yes,
well,
sir.
It's an honor to be on yours. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. So, Carrie, for those of my listeners that don't know, like, give a little bit of background, what you do, and just your message. That'd be cool.
Yeah, sure. I started out in law thinking that's what I was going to do with my life. Went into law school, met my wife there, best thing to come out of it. Finished up law, but felt a call into seminary. So I went to seminary and then, again, not sure what to do with that, but came up north of Toronto. I'm from Canada. So north from Toronto in the middle of seminary, started at three little tiny churches, and they had just a handful of people at each of them. They'd been in decline for decades, you know, 100-year-old churches. And we started to see growth. And so I stayed, and actually that eventually became Kinexus Church, which I led until 2015 as the founding pastor. We morphed out of a denomination and into Kinexus Church and handed things off. We're still involved at the church, still love the church. I was there yesterday on Sunday. We love it. But I'm not leading it anymore. And I started doing some writing and blogging and podcasting as a hobby, and it kind of blew up. And now it's what I do full time. So I try to equip leaders, business leaders, but mostly church leaders. And we try to help them identify and break their next church, their next growth barrier. That's what we do.
Yeah. You've been very instrumental to me as a young leader. I would think I was 29. At the time, and I just came into a dying church plant at the time. I got voted in 26-1, and then I grew it down to 19 before it went back up. You know how that is. But I learned very early on that there was a lot of things I didn't know about leadership, and I didn't have a seminary degree, and so I had to read a bunch of books and listen to your podcast. So.
Tell me about it. That's why I started it, man. I went to law school and nobody taught me how to run a law firm. And I went to seminary and no one taught me how to run a church. And I saw badly run law firms. I mean, that's why the sign's always changing at law firms, right? You know, it was Lunday, Newhoff, and whatever. And then Lunday's gone and Newhoff's in, and then Newhoff's gone and the next guy's in. And that's because they can't get along. They don't know how to lead it. And, you know, you'd think, well, with an education like that and an income like that, you'd be able to figure it out. Nope, you can't. So I try to fill in the gaps. I try to help leaders figure out what they didn't learn in school.
Yeah, you've been very instrumental on helping organizations really, really scale into the next phase of growth for whatever size they're at, right? I think you've been very gifted at that. And we just so happen to be in this space where we're kind of not going back from COVID, right? And you have this, I don't know, I would definitely call it a gift of helping organizations move to a second S-curve. You did it in your time as a pastor, which for those people that are in the business world that you don't realize how hard it is to move an entrenched community into a new thing. Like, it's easier
of volunteers who don't need to be there,
yes,
who don't get paid to be there, and who have to pay you to keep coming.
Yes.
Right? Like, you theoretically, they have to give to keep it alive.
Yeah. That is a much bigger challenge, and yet you did it pretty successfully. Obviously, there were some hiccups along the road, and I would love to talk about, you know, emotional health in the middle of all of this. Because I know that was a journey that you guys have been on. You've been on as well, and your wife. And but how do you help organizations move on to the next S curve? So this, we talked about the sigmoidal curve, going like, hey, there's this spot in the road where you really need to make a shift into the next phase or you'll die. How do you do that without losing your identity?
Well, I think the sigmoid curve is really easy the first time around. So in your situation, Chesley, in my situation, you come back, you inherit somebody else's mess or whatever, you know, be charitable about it. But so you inherit someone else's situation and it's pretty easy to be the new guy, the under new management person. And you come in and you make some changes and things start to grow. But, you know, as the sigmoid curve theory goes, eventually it starts to peak. Smart leaders will start to disturb the status quo as the organization is reaching peak, not even there yet, but reaching it. Most people don't. They're kind of like, look at this. This is working great. And then you start going down the S curve. And, you know, at that point, everyone's like, well, there's fewer people here than there were a year ago. There's less momentum, less excitement. Now, how do we change? So the smart leader is ahead of that. But however you get there, whether you're before the curve, after the dip, you know, a lot of us get to our second S curve, but then we're reinventing what we did, which is really a lot more challenging because, you know, you would never say it publicly, but the old guy was the bad guy. The old regime was the bad regime. And, you know, here we are new and shiny and we fixed everything. And then you come along and it's like, oh no, what I did worked 3 years ago, but doesn't work anymore. Not the same way. And COVID just accelerated that, right? Where a lot of models broke, a lot of distribution systems broke, a lot culture accelerated a decade in about 2 years. So stuff like working from home, it was sort of a niche thing. I mean, in 2019, I released a course called The High Impact Workplace that was all about, hey, way off in the future, people are going to want to work from home. And if you pay attention to Gen Z and millennials, you're going to see more of them want flexibility in their workplace. And, you know, boomer and older Gen X bosses were like, what is this? This is stupid. No, no, no. And, you know, millennials were kind of like, yeah, you get it. And so were Gen Z. But I had to scrap that course a year after I launched it, because suddenly everybody was working from home and everybody wanted flex hours. So now it's back as the art of team leadership remade for another era. But like that's what pandemics do. So we all got accelerated. So now you're on the second uptick of the sigmoid curve, as you said. Now, what's the problem with that? Is the method that you're currently seeing momentum with, if you're seeing momentum at all, probably has a 3 to 5 year shelf life. And what's going to happen again is inevitably it's going to crest and peak, and then it's going to go into decline. And there's two ways to solve that problem. One is keep changing jobs every 5 to 7 years, because then you can come in and sweep the old regime out and start new and ride that S curve and get out before it dips. The other way to do it is, like in the case of me, I was probably through 3 S curves in my 20 years of leadership of our church. And we're just through another one in my company right now. We just got back 2 weeks ago from a retreat in Florida. We got like a fresh vision. Like you got to reinvent yourself. You've got to reinvent yourself. Most good ideas. So, I mean, I could talk for days on this, but most good ideas have a 5 to 7 year shelf life, right? What got Apple out of the gate? It's a 30, 40, 40? 5 year legacy company. It's been around a long time, but it's got multiple iterations, right? The startup years and then John Sculley and then Jobs is back and sort of the golden age. And then Tim Cook took it to whole new levels with a valuation Steve Jobs probably never dreamed of, et cetera, et cetera. But multiple sigmoid curves. So the other solution is you got to keep reinventing yourself. And if you think about that in music, it makes sense. Most bands come out of the gate strong. And Taylor Swift is probably breaking this curve right now because she's, as we record this, she is all 10 spots in the Billboard Top 100. Never been done. The Beatles didn't do it. Eagles never did it. Elton John didn't do it. Michael Jackson didn't do it. Taylor Swift has done it, locked up all 10 spots. But what did Taylor Swift do? She's been around for what, 13 years now?
Oh,
yeah.
More
2009,
than
earlier?
Yeah.
Earlier, yeah. 2006. When did she break through? So 15
She's
years.
A couple years younger than I am. So it was, yeah, it's about around 15.
15 years. So what did she do? She pulled back from her management team, reinvented her image, re-recorded a lot of her songs, and then from folklore on kind of said, now you're going to hear from me.
Yeah.
So she has a second career. If she was still like, when was the last time Rihanna had a huge hit or Beyonce? they tend to come out of the gate and they go strong, bunch of number ones, and everybody who still knows who they are, but they haven't reinvented themselves like Taylor has. So I think that's a challenge on the S curve.
I think that's really, really good. I just, one of the things that I've been thinking through is, you know, as you get there, you don't have a playbook, and, you know, churches, even most organizations, they're really looking at what they've done before, and they don't have a playbook for how to move forward. And innovation is something that is, you know, it's disruptive. So either you're creating something new or you're tearing something down. You really don't get a happy medium there. How do you help organizations begin to build continuous innovation in their system so that the shift every 5 to 7 years isn't so like earth shattering?
Couple of things. Number one, yeah, I think you can. I mean, you have to. I think it starts with the senior leader, the CEO, the lead pastor, whoever that happens to be. It starts with the leader. You have to stay agile and hungry. I mean, and flexible. So the real temptation is the system you pioneered, the method that you created, and you almost want a TM, like this is my thing. You have to hold that really loosely, because the reason it worked was it was the right system, the right method for the culture in a particular moment. And the reason it won't work in the future is the culture moved on. As Rick Warren said famously years ago, you know, the pace of change is determined by culture and what's changing faster, the culture or the church. Answer, culture. So when that happens, the gap between how fast the culture changes versus how fast you change is called irrelevance. And so you can get irrelevant super, super fast as a leader. So you got to hold your methods loosely, but you want to hold the mission tightly. And a lot of us get more attached to our methods, the system that I created, the system I've used that made us successful, than we do to our mission. And so what I try to do, and this was a season for me this summer where I kind of revisited the mission. So we just came back, you know, from a period of rethinking the vision. And the vision for our company is to reverse the decline in the church, which is an impossible vision. Like, the decline is so fast, we cannot do it alone. But my team's galvanized around that. I'm galvanized around that. And if you are white hot around the vision, then you will rethink your methods. And that's, in fact, what we're doing. We're rethinking our email strategy, our blog strategy, our podcast strategy, our CRM. We're rethinking, we want to improve the Art of Leadership Academy, which you're a part of. Like, we're doing that all through the light of the vision. I'm making client calls this week and calling our top partners and saying, hey, we're refining the vision. Like, that breathes new life into the mission, and it brings new life into somebody who has led for a long time. So I would say, if you're struggling with that, you want a white hot sense of mission, and you also want the ability then to rethink your methods so that that mission stays white hot.
Yeah. Okay. So I like to talk innovation and innovative leadership. And I was going to go business, but I think we need to go church, because that's actually my heart. You're right. So
go wherever you want.
Yeah. Super excited about like your vision. One of the things that keeps jumping out at me, though, is that there's this book by Clayton Christensen. He talks about competing against luck, and it's about jobs theory. Do you remember? Have you heard about jobs theory?
Haven't read it. No, so don't know it. Haven't read it.
He wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, but I think the best one, because it actually brings it down to earth and how to handle it in your organization, is Competing Against Luck. And he talks about jobs theory, about what is the job to be done. And so you have this white hot vision of making sure that you guys can eradicate decline in the church. And yet you've got these types of people that have a framework, a methodology that has been passed down for 1700 years. And the reality is, there's a job to be done for people that live in the 21st century. What job do they hire the church to solve in their lives? That's what he means by this. Jobs theory.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. All right. Do people hire the church to solve in their life. And when you begin to think through that, the methodology must shift, because you might need to do something very different. One of the first story he tells about is this restaurant that serves milkshakes. And when they're looking at places to innovate, at 9:30 in the morning, they had a spike in the number of milkshakes that were bought. And when they started researching around it, they realized that the reason why these people bought it was because a milkshake was easy to hold on to in rush hour traffic, and it would hold them over till lunch to be able to get them through the meeting. And so it became like, oh, there's this job we didn't even realize that the milkshake was being hired to do. There's probably a better answer than the milkshake. And now we have a new product line that we can create because of it. And so there's these new ways of thinking about the job that people hire churches to do. And so as you guys are talking about this in your business, in your organization, like, I would love to talk a little bit more about innovation, where you think the church is headed, and maybe the methodology behind it, because we're in the biggest shift in 500 years, probably the biggest shift in 1700 years since Constantine. Where do you think we're headed?
Well, I mean, there's so many different directions you could take it. I think as to the job, the way I process the job of the church is, I think the average person who's either part of a church or considering even being part of a church and is on the outside is saying, you need to do two things. You need to connect me with God, connect me with community. Now, they don't know that they need to be connected with community, because everything is so individualistic in our culture.
Yes.
But there's two problems with that. Like 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 200 years ago, church is how you connected with community. Everybody knew it was communal. And church is also how you connected with God. Everybody knew it was organizational. Now, the problem with our culture, with postmodern culture, is the first need is no longer, people don't understand that the church is necessary to connect them with God. We have unparalleled access to information. We have unparalleled access. And we're also very suspect of authority, very suspect of institutions. Mm-hmm. And we make up our own religion, right? Number one rising religion in America is the rise of the nuns, people who profess no religion. But if you break that down and you go talk to the average person who says, yeah, I'm no religion, and you ask them the second question, am I an atheist? They will say, no, I'm not an atheist. Like, I'm spiritual. I'm a good person. I'm Christian-ish, Buddhist-ish. You know, I'm spiritual, I'm Oprah-ish, or whatever that happens to be. You know, I meditate, I'm into Stoicism, I listen to Ryan Holiday. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll come up, so they're like, do you need the church for that? And they're like, no, absolutely not. The church is going to get in the way. And then, well, what about your need for community? Well, you know, I got my friends, and I'm online, and, you know, I'm on Tinder, on and on it goes, right? So the church has a problem now, because 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, if you want to know about God, you knew you had to go to the church. Well, now nobody trusts the church. Nobody thinks about the church, mm-hmm. and they have the answer to everything at their fingertips, on their phone. So that got eradicated. Now, that doesn't change the fact, I'm not Roman Catholic, I don't believe that the church is the means to salvation. Mm-hmm. Lots of Roman Catholic friends, they're great people.
Yeah.
I just have a slightly different take on it than that. But I do believe the church is extremely helpful. I think my Christian journey looks very different when I separate it from the church. I don't think it goes as well. And I would make that case for anybody. So now, you know, because people no longer see the church as a viable option, that first connection point is gone. So how do you combat that? I think you combat that a couple ways. You take the second thing and you connect them to community. So when the church shows up, our church did a reverse offering a couple of weeks ago, gave out $15,000 in envelopes on a Sunday morning. Mm. And it was somewhere between $25 and $75. It's like, go out and bless the community. So my wife and I, we multiplied the money. We gave it to a single mom who is running a food bank and will not draw a salary from that charity, but needs winter tires. Okay, we heard about that situation. Here's some money. This will pretty much cover the winter tires. We'll take care of that. Other people went in and they blessed a restaurant server or whatever. Or somebody went to a fast food restaurant one day and said, you don't look happy, here's $100. And then you tell the story of our church gave a reverse offering and this is out to bless you. Well, that makes a very positive connection with people in the community who go, oh, you're actually for me, like Jeff Henderson's For initiative, if you followed that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, what you start doing is you start upping the community aspect of it because people are desperately lonely. People don't have friends. Online relationships are good, but they're not really the value of real relationships. And in the process, and this is thoroughly consistent with scripture, you know, Jesus said, what's the principal commandment? It is love the Lord your God, that's with God, with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's community.
Yeah.
And so it's the community of me to you that can introduce God. And then if the church becomes a conduit of community, where we're not just about a club that gathers, but also people who go out in the community who reach people and they finally go, okay, what is this thing that is motivating you? It's like, oh, we'll have a conversation about faith.
Yeah, that's
really... So I don't know whether that helps.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. What do you think about the new models that are beginning to pop up? I know we've had house church for a long time, but I see these micro church networks, more of a hub and node situation, like an organizational structure. And then you have, you know, digital church, which is what I have been working on. Like, where do you think that's headed and how this plays long term in the way we're handling innovation in the church and this disruption?
Well, I think what we're seeing emerge, and these are just like tiny little seedlings. So it's early days with the house, not house churches, but the micro churches, micro expressions, the node version, et cetera, and church online, way healthier than the old house church movement.
Yeah.
The problem with the old house church movement was it was a bunch of angry, disgruntled Christians who didn't like any other institution, resisted authority, met in their living room with 10 other malcontents and died there. Yep. You know, there was no outward thrust. True. And the church, and maybe you had a good house church experience. I'm sorry if you did, and that seemed unjust. But the house church movement went nowhere. It just went nowhere. It was probably the precursor to anti-institutionalism. So I don't want to associate with an organization, institution. I will become that. But they died. They didn't grow, really. And where they did grow overseas in Korea, they were very organized and completely different than what you saw in America or the Western world, which was a bunch of angry people who couldn't associate with other people. So I think what you're seeing now, these micro expressions are connected to a bigger whole. Mm-hmm. They are outward looking, not inward looking, and they have growth as a mindset. I think there's great potential in that.
Some people think Paul just worked with his hands, and he did, but he also raised funds. Don't believe me? Check out Philippians 4, 1 Corinthians 10, and Romans 15. In fact, when the kingdom of God catapulted forward, there was usually a kingdom-minded businessman or woman behind it, like Priscilla and Aquila. If you're going to raise funds, though, do it well. Our partners, Reliant, can help you put rocket fuel in your fundraising tank. I wish I'd had this when I was church planning, but Reliant can partner with you to get you the training and coaching you need to raise that support, as well as provide you with employment services you may need like payroll, health benefits, and more. To learn more, check out reliant.org/CPP.
Yeah, I've been thinking about, you know, we've got a few years before we have the hyper rail system, you know, another decade. But Marchetti's Constant says 30 minutes of travel. But when you're able to go to LA to San Francisco in 30 minutes, that's going to shift us completely, like that model. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking through that and going, it's on its way here. So a network style of gathering is going to make more sense the more detached from geography we get.
Well, it's true. I mean, there are, like, I forget exactly who it is, wrote a book recently, and I haven't read it. I've just heard a podcast interview on it, so it's dangerous. But network states, this idea that people are affiliating not by geography, which is historically how states organize, but by ideology or partisanship or worldview. And in many ways, that's kind of what's happening. Like if you look at the collapse of denominations, what was a denomination? A denomination was often geographically based, or if it expanded beyond national boundaries, it was ideologically based, but it became a code of how we do things. It became, this is how we do worship, this is how we do polity, this is how we do discipline, et cetera, et cetera. And it was kind of a rigid, closed system. You either joined it or you didn't. You saw a lot of people disaffiliate from denominations. And what we've moved into in the last 50 years is an affinity-based world. In other words, and that's happened within denominations. I mean, you go to a particular strand of Baptist churches 70 years ago, they looked exactly the same. I mean, you know, the order of service, Anglican, Episcopalian, very similar liturgy, Book of Common Prayer, right? So whether you were at with the Archbishop of Canterbury or some local priest in a tiny village in rural America, you're doing the same book of prayer. What's happened now is as that affinity culture becomes greater, is you can go to Anglican churches that feel Pentecostal. And then you can go to Pentecostal churches that feel Anglican. Yep. And you have this range of people. And now, in the last 30 years, you've seen dissociation from those denominations and these networks arise. And people are basically organizing themselves around affinity. And then you enter a pandemic. That happened even more. You have people moving to different states for, quote, tax reasons, but also for political and ideological reasons. I want to live in a blue state. I want to live in a red state. I want to live in a red city. I want to live in a blue city. And so all of a sudden you have this ideological migration that is happening. And that's why, you know, the rise of non-denominational churches or interdenominational churches, it's like people are just landing where they want to land, and why you can do what you do and I can do what I do with the Art of Leadership Academy. We have people from every walk of life in the church world there, and we all get along, but we're united by this common mission. So I think that, like, you know, brand loyalty, denominational loyalty, it's gone out the window. And if you're counting on loyalty to build whatever you're leading, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, that's good. Obviously, we're going to have some struggles in figuring out how to shift from this new, I don't know, it's especially since COVID, you're starting to see the more and more the cracks of the old system on where, you know, where this bounded set that you're talking about has, has given us some safety and some comfort. And now, right now, we have all these innovators that are starting to pop up and are like, starting to get their moments in the sun. But I find that hubris can be a problem, right? And so when we start getting a lot more notoriety, I think the digital church has gotten a lot more notoriety in the last 24 months than it had ever. And, you know, and yet I think there's some, I think it's still, it's gonna be adopted more and more and more. What do the innovators in any set, whether it's any model, what are the innovators missing when they begin to get out front and they get the notoriety? What do you think most leaders forget when they start getting a lot of press, a lot of good press?
I think the cautionary tale for all of us who have seen some momentum in our lives or who are getting good press is, number one, believing that press. I mean, most of us have made as many mistakes or more mistakes than we've made good shots. And secondly, you hinted at it, it's hubris. It's a lack of humility. And I think one of the reasons we've seen, you hear about it in the church a lot more than in business, because in business, it's just another day. In the church, it's an exception to the rule. And I hope it will always be an exception to the rule. But when you see moral collapse, not always, but often, what happens is the platform grew faster than that leader's character. And I'm not saying I'm bulletproof. I'm not saying I'm never going to fall. I'm not saying that. I'm not claiming that. I think if you begin to think that way, you're setting yourself up for a fall. But I am tremendously grateful that the success, if I've had any success, and you know, the trajectory in my life has happened in the last 10 years, not in my 20s or 30s. Because I didn't have the character to sustain it. I didn't. I mean, we led a church to 600 or 700 people in the first decade of ministry, and I collapsed. And it didn't have collateral damage. I didn't lose my marriage, didn't have an affair, didn't quit my job, didn't steal money, didn't do any of that. It was like an internal implosion. But my goodness, if I had the level of, quote, success or knownness that I had now, I think it could have been way worse. And God was gracious enough to give me, you know, no lasting consequences from that other than I had a crappy year and probably burned a few bridges, small bridges that, you know, I try to repair without any major catastrophe. Because I think if your platform outgrows your character, you're toast.
Yeah. I've been meaning to ask this question because I've heard your story about burnout and what it's taken to get back. And yeah, obviously you've done so much good since you've been there. Does it come with age or is it like I'm 36, but I, you know,
you talked about
it happening in your 40s. I read Arthur Brooks' From Strength to Strength and then Richard Rohr's Falling Up.
I haven't read that, but it's on my list.
Yeah. So he talks about the second half of life and like, is there an ability to tap in? I know we talk about character formation a lot, but it just seems to happen in your 40s for the most part.
Yes, but it's not inevitable. So having read Arthur Brooks, that was really good. I would say wisdom and age are frequent companions, but not inevitable companions, because there is such thing as an old fool. And as someone who's got 20 years on you, here's what I see. And I've had to check this inside myself. So back to the sigmoid curve conversation, and I think Brooks gets at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, he was trying to play French horn professionally and peaked at 19 or 17, and then at 31 still couldn't get on to a symphony orchestra or become a first French hornist or whatever that is. You know, there's a lot of people who at 50 are still trying to be first French horn in some orchestra, and everybody else could be their kids, right? So you have those people at my age and stage in their mid to late 50s who are still trying to play that game. And that's foolish and that's stupid. But I feel those impulses. It's like when, you know, he talks about fluid versus crystallized intelligence. Mm-hmm. Fluid intelligence comes in the early part of life where, you know, you got all these breakthroughs, all these ideas, you've got back to that sigmoid curve, your system, your method that kind of broke ground and you're the innovator and you're the man, you're the woman, the whole deal. And then a lot of people still try to play that game. And he said that ends around 40. So Chesley, you got 4 years left. I just hate to tell you that, but that's about it. And then you move into hopefully crystallized intelligence. So I remember I was 42. And I would say in my first 20 years of leadership, like 10 years in my 20s, I was in school because it took the roundabout route into ministry. But everything seemed like a mystery. It's like, why did that person leave? Why did those people get divorced? Why did this church grow? Why did this church fail? Everything seemed kind of flat and equal. And then in my early 40s, I started to get better at pattern recognition, which Brooks talks about. And I would be like, I've seen this before. That's why those guys left. You investigate. Yep, that's why they left. Take some notes. Wait a minute. These growing churches, they all have that in common. Okay, take some notes. Like pattern recognition became a lot easier for me. Now, I'm on the other side of burnout, the other side of a much bigger life problem than I ever expected to have. But that's when the dots started to connect. But then the next thing is, and I've had good conversations with people my age, a bit younger, a bit older, is you can use that knowledge to become cynical. Like knowledge and cynicism are frequent companions. So you can become the guy who's like, oh, let me tell you why your enterprise is going to fail, Chesley. Boom, 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 boom. Here's the pattern recognition. Sucks to be you. Right? I could do that.
Yeah.
That's not a very nice way to live. Like you're not a good person if you're doing that. So how do you use that knowledge? And then are you able, like one of my goals in life is to stay curious. At 80, if I'm alive, I want to be more curious than I am today. Mm-hmm. I want to be looking for new patterns. I want to be looking for new things. I want to be looking for exceptions to the rule. And, you know, the other challenge is you see all the patterns. And as Solomon said, with great knowledge comes sorrow, right? The more knowledge I had, the more grief I had. Yeah. Why were you so happy when you were young? because you were stupid. You didn't know anything. Yeah. And now you know everything and you're like, oh, yeah. And you see all that. So that can become like if you've ever read any part of the Bible and you're a little bit into philosophy, read the book of Ecclesiastes, richest, wisest man in the world who's like, I've got it all. And my conclusion is it's meaningless. It's meaningless. It's meaningless.
Yeah.
You get there. You get there in your 50s unless you decide not to. So it's definitely things start to happen with crystallized intelligence if you let them and you don't get cynical and you stay curious. You know, as Michael Bungay Sr. says, stay curious longer. I want to stay curious longer. I don't want, like when you tell me new book, a younger me would have tried to cover up the fact that I hadn't read Richard Rohr. I want to be at the point where I'm like, oh, that'll be an awesome read when I get to it. I can't wait to see what I discover, as opposed to, well, you know,
right.
You don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, I get that. I've been playing around with this, you know, at 36 and realizing I'm just not wired for certain things that I wish I was wired for. And if I'm going to continue down the road, like my goal was giga church pastor at some point. But man, I start things. I'm not a good manager, you know, trying to do it the way that everybody else has done it. It was just not working out for me. And at 36, sitting there going like, if I keep beating this drum, I'm going to end up in a place where I'm going to be more upset than I've ever been before. And probably even if I got it, I'd be dying inside because I'm just not wired for that. And I think I've had to make the shift earlier into this new way of doing things. Yeah. So I love your answer.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know that you want more on that or not.
Oh, I would love it. Open? If you want to give me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought I was going to pastor this really large church and Kinexus became a larger church. Yeah. I mean, I led it to 1100 in weekly attendance and then Jeff, my successor, has taken it further and we were one of the, I don't know, maybe top 100 in the country or something like that in Canada, which is great. But I always thought it would be 10x that. And it didn't. And most of the people I know, now, if you're like, so Carrie, what turn did your life take? Did you expect at 57 to have a podcast that was listened to by millions of leaders? And I'd be like, what's a podcast? I don't even know. I have no idea. Like,
right.
You know, I did not see this coming. And if I talk to most people who pastor mega churches, giga churches, etc., this is so way past anything they had a category for. And I can resonate that not in terms of church. I mean, it did get bigger than I thought it would get. And that's why I took succession seriously. Yeah. But like what I'm doing now, way beyond. Like I didn't even have a category for it. It wasn't even an idea when I started writing or when I started podcasting. I thought, okay, maybe a million downloads a decade in. Well, not even 10 years in and 25 million downloads. I'm like, okay, I got to do that. Eventually your gaskets kept blown. You're like, I didn't know. But what did happen, and this is I'm rereading Atomic Habits, goals can be demotivating. And what you want, I totally agree with James Clear on this, is you want to find the habits. Like what are the patterns? And Todd Wilson from Exponential helped me see this. And I wouldn't have seen it on my own, but like I have a really weird career. At 16, I walk into a radio station and say, hire me. And then I started writing a syndicated column for a local newspaper chain when I was 19. Who does that?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I went into law, but I love being in court. My wife doesn't like being, well, she's good at it, but she prefers to draft contracts. I'm like, forget the contract, go litigate it. Right. Like I love being in court. Favorite part of a preaching job as a pastor, preaching. And then what do? I become a podcaster, a writer, an author, a speaker. So what glues all of those things together over four decades? Communication.
Yeah.
Bottom line, and Todd helped me see this. Carrie, you're a communicator.
Yeah.
Oh, so I have a communications company. There's a thread in there, Chesley, for you, even at 36, that you can look back on because you will automatically come back to that through line in your life. Like it's just going to keep showing up again and again. Maybe you're a starter. Maybe you're an innovator. Maybe you're I don't know what it is. I don't know you well enough for that. But like if you start to look for those clues and ask the people around you, and then what has impact? Yeah. Every time I've communicated well, like even in that 1 year in law, I was in court almost every day. I lost twice.
Wow.
And I know why I lost. I can tell you those cases. Yeah. Once I wasn't prepared and the other was, well, we can talk about that, but the principals who put me on that case, it's like, guys, this is unwinnable. All right. Yeah. You're acting like children. The judge is going to tell you you're acting like children. And that's what the judge did. It was an indefensible case. Other than that, I won. And, you know, what is that? Because I love the communication. I love the sport of it. I love when I'm writing a blog post. I was talking about this with Brian Clark, formerly of Copy Blogger. Like, he's a lawyer as well. It's like, yeah, we're going to the Supreme Court and we're arguing our case with our keyboards. Like, that's what I love doing. I'm a communicator. So can I do that for the next 20, 30 years? Probably, in one form or another.
Yeah. I mean, because it's just innate in you. So, and I love that about talking about the second half of Curve. You just end up finding that spot. You just like, okay, this is who I am, rather than trying to either fight against it or accelerate or trying to figure out a new thing. Like, you just
start. Yeah. And mostly it's, as you said, who you're not. Yeah. Like, I'm not a creative. I'm not a good project manager. Our whole team runs on Asana. We had a meeting today. We're setting up this huge, massive project. I'm like, I don't know how to run that thing. But give me the content and I'll produce it. Like, you know, if it, and it got that way with the church. Like, if Kinexus broke when I was a lead pastor, I would no longer know how to fix it. Right. In the early days, I knew how to fix everything. I knew how to unplug the toilet. I knew everything. Like, but like, if Kinexus broke, I couldn't fix it. I was relying, because I was a communicator and the vision caster. Mm. Now with my company, in the early days, when it was a hobby, I knew everything, with a couple of exceptions. And then when it became a company, I'm like, yeah, I know. And now I know 10% of what goes on in our company, because I'm the communicator. I'm the visionary. That's it.
Yeah.
That's what I do. And if I get into the weeds, I ruin the thing I'm trying to build.
Yeah. No, that's big. I, you know, for me, it's more strategy. I love to communicate. I think it's because I like to communicate strategy, you know, so I definitely understand that. I'd love to shift a little bit, because you brought, you know, you brought to us the second half of life. We've talked about that. We've talked about innovation. And then, you know, as we move into more digital spaces, we have to be, what, you know, Rory Baden says, that we have to think about reputation, and you have to build a platform, because platform is reputation. Except this has been a really interesting conversation that I've had in the church world. A lot of times when we talk about platforms and building it, a lot of people are against it. They think it's not helpful. And then I've actually would love to have this conversation with you, because I feel saying that it's not good to have one is actually a limited conversation. I definitely understand the fact that you're like, hey, don't let your character be less than your platform. You cannot have your platform outpacing your character. And yet we live in a digital space where it feels like platform, like building a platform, you have to do that. You have to build a brand around your name if you're going to get in any space that has any amount of public influence. And I'm saying that as a church pastor of, you know, maybe even 150 in Akron, Ohio, right? I think there's a level of building a platform that is inevitable in the digital age. So I would love to talk about that and see what your thoughts are. And if you even think that's, if you think I'm wrong, like, I would love to talk about that too. I would love to hear your thoughts on building platforms.
I think it's a really delicate balancing act. So again, you know, I started doing what I'm doing before anybody even knew what a platform was. Mm-hmm. You know, platform was a piece of wood you stood on to deliver a talk, right? So there was no social media profile when I started ministry when I was in law, like, you know, but we had media. And if you made the headlines, if you made Leadership Journal or Fox News or CNN, it was because you did something significant. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the rules have changed. Like, I didn't set out to build a platform. I set out to help leaders. Mm-hmm. And in the process, a platform got built. And I've talked about this. I don't want to drop names, but I've talked about this with some of the you know, people in the church sphere who I would just say one, their first name, and you know exactly who I'm talking about, like that level.
Yeah.
None of them tried to build a platform. They were just doing really meaningful work and somehow got upvoted. Now, you know, they did have a social media account. They did try to figure out how to leverage it when it happened, but it wasn't like, okay, we're starting at zero. We're going to build a big platform. And I think the challenge for younger leaders, you know, if you're under 40, is you can so focus on building a platform mm-hmm. that you forget what it's about. And what I would do is try to have a cause that's so important to you and a work that is significant enough that it basically gets upvoted by the internet. Because if you're really good at something, it's going to get noticed. If you're an incredible artist, you're going to get noticed. If you're a killer musician, you're going to get noticed. And, you know, I get sent books almost every day. And it's one thing to get a publishing deal, but, you know, some books can look really good on the outside, but you're two chapters in and you're like, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. But if a book is sensational, like, you know, I'm not trying to debate theology, but a good case study is The Shack. Now, I know a lot of people disagree with The Shack, the whole deal. But when William Paul Young, when Paul Young was writing that book, he was writing it for his kids. And he went to Kinko's. And I stayed in the house he wrote that book in once, which was really cool.
That's cool.
It was just for a speaking engagement. Yeah. They put me up there. And, you know, he went to Kinko's and he gave it to his kids as a gift. And then they started sharing it with people because they thought it was so good. And then he shared it with a few friends and they're like, you need to print 10 more copies. And before you knew it, it was just supply and demand. And I think he self-published it. Somebody can fact check me, but I think he self-published it. And then a major publisher picked it up and, you know, millions of copies later,
it
got upvoted. I'm talking to James Clear from Atomic Habits soon, which is why I'm rereading the book. Similar story. I mean, he just started blogging about habits because he was trying to improve his own and the world showed up. And that eventually led to a blog and then a podcast and then a book deal and 4 million copies later in 6 years, which is unbelievable. You know, he's got a thing on his hands and he just kept working in this one lane on habits. He didn't set out to build a platform.
Yeah.
He set out to make a difference with habits. So I would ask, you know, what is your unique contribution to the world? I'm pattern recognition for church leaders. If you really want to break it down, that's what I do. I help you see things that you already know. Like you know, my stuff isn't really revolutionary, but it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Right. That is why that person left. This is what's happening in the church. I put labels and names on things you see, but you haven't got the time or the energy to document. That's what I do. Yeah. And then in my podcast, I bring world-class leaders to bear on some of the problems that we're all facing.
Yeah. So it's not the platform that's the problem. It's a platform without a mission and a message that's the problem.
I agree. And if you focus on the mission and the message and you and start to pick up traction, you'll figure out the platform.
Yeah.
You'll figure it out, right?
So good. So,
and the other problem with building a platform is, and this is well documented, but you're building it in rented space. Yeah. So I got a text from a mega church leader in Atlanta today who's like, is your Instagram dropping? And I'm like, yeah, it's been stopped. Like, haven't really looked much. And I came downstairs. I have a counter a friend gave me. Yeah, we lost 150 followers today or something. There's something going on with the algorithm. Mm-hmm. It's like, at the end of the day, I don't really care.
Yeah.
Because I'm not building my life on Instagram. My goal is not to have 2 million followers on Instagram. And you could argue now TikTok's a way better bet than, or Be Real. Well, Be Real, you can't really build a platform on Be Real. But, you know, that stuff is going to change. Meta, Facebook, is down 60% in shareholder value year to date.
Yeah.
And it's you know, nobody under 30 is there except for groups and Facebook Marketplace.
Yeah.
That's it. It's the only reason they're there. Big. It's not a social media network. So if you build, somebody said it this way to me. It's like, if you build a platform on Instagram or Facebook, it's like building your dream house on a digital volcano.
Yep.
You never know when it's going to go off.
Yep.
And a bunch of engineers in Silicon Valley decide this is a new algorithm and you go from massive momentum to death overnight.
Yeah.
So you gotta take that with a grain of salt. Now, I think there's a much smarter way to build out an online business. That's an owned space, not rented space, emails, websites, your own distribution system, stuff Mighty like Networks. The Art of Leadership Academy. Mighty Networks.
Very much.
Who hosts the Art of Leadership Academy. We own that. No algorithm's going to change that.
Yep.
So
that's what I've been telling church leaders as we've been talking digital ministry for a long time is you market on those spaces and then you build community on own space. Very much so. I think Brady talks about that. You have talked about it, but you can't build a organization off of luck and something you can't control. So
I think most people would say there is an awful lot of luck, providence. Like, you know, I was saying to a friend today, you know, I could not have predicted what was going to happen. And there are a lot of people who are probably better human beings who worked harder, who deserve more, who didn't get it. And for whatever reason, you know, there are definitely bigger platforms in the world, but there's a lot of good fortune, luck, grace involved in any platform that grows. And I'll be the first to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. But I think the thing that I have seen too out of all of this is just the relationships. I think, you know, you have the innate ability because of church planting and leading an organization that you knew the structure you had to build once you had it. So you had the experience, which is important. The next thing is you had the communication chops. You can't be boring on this stuff. Like, you've got to at least be good at what you do. And then the next thing is, like, who do you know? Like,
right.
3 years ago, I was a youth pastor in a 500 member church. You know, nobody knew me.
Except right.
for the fact that I did two things differently. I said, I love to help churches win at innovation. So digital ministry was starting to take off, and I was a part of that. So I did that in student ministry, and then COVID hit, and I was hanging out with friends that did digital ministry. But in the process, I knew two things that could happen that would really help. Find people in their sphere and their network that I could get to know, and how do I add value? Me having Carrie Newhoff on my podcast was not an accident. I would like to tell you it was. It wasn't. You know, it was me going, how can I make Carrie's Art of Leadership a better place in a way that I would serve him and add value so that one day he would not have a problem with coming on my podcast?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have 1,400 leaders who are in the Art of Leadership Academy. I don't know all of them by name. I mean, I see when people join up, who do I notice? I notice the active people, and you're always adding value. You're always like chiming in on someone, posting, encouraging someone who needs encouragement. So when my EA said, hey, Chesty Lunde wants you on his podcast, I'm like, that's an automatic yes. And it's usually an automatic no.
No, I know.
You're right. You added value
on your podcast, but it's like, who do I know? Like, Dylan's wife was my barista in Omaha, Maggie. Like, so yeah. I've been hanging around your circles for a long time. You just didn't
know.
That's
awesome.
You know, talking.
But, you know, going back in the day, for people who aren't connected, I mean, please join the Art of Leadership Academy, whatever. But, you know, when you're saying, like, who do you know that you can add value to or even mentor you? My first answer to that was a guy named Doug who lives 10 minutes from where I'm sitting right now. And Doug led the 200-person church in our denomination in our region, the largest Presbyterian church. I was Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. You know, Craig Rochelle, who was starting Life Church. I barely knew Craig, you know. Craig, we're friends now, but he wasn't going to meet with me.
Right.
But Doug would. Doug would have lunch with me. So I picked Doug's brain. I like, hey, what can I do? Like, then I met a guy named Chuck who led the largest church in our denomination. He's been a mentor of mine for over 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, he would meet with me. And then I got on a plane and I went to a conference. And now, you know, obviously there's podcasting and books, but Rick Warren, who I've had the privilege of interviewing a few times, you know, Rick was my mentor because for $20, I bought The Purpose Driven Church and then The Purpose Driven Life. Mm-hmm. And he became a virtual mentor before he became a friend.
Right.
So I think one of the pitfalls of today's age is to assume that, you know, all of us have access to Craig Rochelle being our best friend or Rick Warren hanging out for a day. Well, you know, now I have friends in those circles, but it started with Doug down the road because Doug would have lunch with me. And I wasn't climbing up. It was just
right.
As you have more opportunities and as you accomplish more, you get like I went to an event as a guest a year ago with some of the top leaders in U.S. churches. I won't name the guest list, but it was incredible. And I didn't have a role. I was just there to be a participant. They asked me to do one thing at lunch, which is great. Today I got a call. It's like, would you like to be a speaker at this year's event?
Yeah.
I wasn't pruning for it. I wasn't asking for it. It was just, all right, I was there to try to be a friend to the people who were there.
Yeah.
And then you kind of get upvoted, right? So I would say that's the best strategy. And that wasn't like networking or platform building. It was just, that's how it goes.
I agree with you. I think taking the time to really care for the people that are around you. Obviously, there's always something that God's put on our hearts to do.
And you do that so well.
Then God will open the doors as you're able to build relationship. I'm not looking to build my platform. I'm looking to build Art of Leadership's platform, right? You know, so.
Right. And I'm looking to build into the people I meet inside the Art of Leadership Academy. Mm-hmm. And that just has a way of somehow, not all the time, but a lot of the time, give that a decade or two. It's like putting $5 in the bank every day. Right now, it looks like nothing. Tomorrow, it looks like 10 bucks. You know, 10 days from now, it looks like 50 bucks. You're like, I could spend that all on lunch if I wanted to. But 20 years down the road, that's, somebody will do the math, 20,000 bucks.
True.
Eventually, it becomes $200,000, right? That's compound interest. And not all of your investments are going to work out. I tried really hard. I did my best. I built into this person. It went nowhere. I built in over here. It went nowhere. But Chesley, you're so good at that in the academy. And I think if you just keep doing that, I mean, it's going to produce some kind of a yield down the road. I don't know what it'll look like. And, you know, I'm almost ready to say platforms take care of themselves.
I would agree with you.
You know what I mean?
The message and the mission, and you take care of other people and relationship, then it'll work.
Like, take look at Cal Newport. I've interviewed him once or twice. And Cal's a really interesting guy. He sold a bajillion books. Mm-hmm. But he's not on social media.
Right.
And so he has this huge platform. He has his own podcast. But he's like, I'm not. He wrote a book called Digital Minimalism. Yeah. He's like, I'm not on social media. He's worried about adding value. And he tries to make sure when his book comes out, when his podcast is out, that he's adding immense value. And he doesn't have to worry about follower count. And the platform kind of builds itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I could talk to you for another hour. I'm not going to, because
this is fine.
I do believe.
Let's do five more minutes.
I'm going to give you a scenario, and then I would love you to just riff on it. Okay. The reason why I started with Brand Builders Group is because I started realizing the Church of the Future online as a digital organization is going to look a lot more like what you're doing and what Dave Ramsey's doing and what some of these other guys. So you got this massive marketing piece up top where it's just the communication. It's getting out the vision and getting out the message. Alongside, you have this framework that you use. You have the Art of Leadership Academy, but you have like a discipleship, a transformation journey. You have it for pastors, right? So you're teaching them the art of leadership, the art of team building, how to change an organization. You have your frameworks. For Dave Ramsey, he has 7 steps to financial peace. Yeah. Along the way, you're building community as you've added value to these people. He built groups in churches because he did this in a pre-digital age. Now he's moving to the digital side where he'll have a community at some point. You have one. I think that is the model for church in the future. And I began to see it. And so I jumped in with Rory's group, which I know he'll be on your podcast at some point. So when you guys see this,
he will,
definitely, probably by the time this airs, it will be on. But I definitely would say, take a look at what Rory says. But I believe that is the church of the future in a digital age. It's actually adding value in these felt need areas and getting community along the way. And this digital infrastructure really allows us to do it because we can do it very cheaply, but it won't be the primary product, won't be the pulpit. It'll be the transformation process. And I would love to hear your riff on that.
No, I agree. So when we introduced the Art of Leadership Academy in early 2022, you know, we used to sell courses, which are sort of the economic heartbeat of my company. Most of what I do is free, right? Podcast is free to the user. The blog posts are free. The email is free, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, we got a team and a lot of leaders that we serve. So we had to figure out, you know, how can we deliver more value? And so our paid products cover everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the courses were like $400 each or whatever. And we thought, okay, well, what if we put them together in a membership? So the price of one course, you get all the courses, and we'll do monthly team training, and we'll do some coaching, et cetera. So we're doing that. But then not quite at the 11th hour, but maybe at the 8th hour, we added community. We found Mighty Networks. We found, which you can white label. It's not cheap, but we white labeled it. So when you get in, you know it's Mighty Networks, but that's because you read the footer and because you're familiar with them. But it looks like you're in the Art of Leadership Academy. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, no offense, not throwing shade at Facebook, but you know, following a conversation on Facebook these days is like 17 clicks later. You don't know where you are in the comments because they keep changing the algorithm so you'll click more. None of that. This is like, it's a pure, simple conversation thread. It's robust enough to have some great articles, great conversation. The secret sauce, less than a year in for the Academy, people love the content. That's great. That's all there. And we thought that's what it was about, but it's turned out to be about the community.
Yeah.
It's actually troll-free dialogue where you can connect with each other in a simple, streamlined way where you met great people like you who are encouraging, who try to solve actual problems that leaders are facing. And we're doubling down on community in that forum. And I think the same could be true for church, because it's great if you have a Facebook group. It's great if you've got, you know, I don't know, a Reddit subthread or something like that. But if you can create something that is a place for content and a place for community, and you do that slipstream between in-person and online, in-person and online, which is where we all live these days,
yeah.
I think that probably is the future. And people are looking to get away from the trolls on the internet and individual platforms because it keeps changing. If you're on Instagram one day and Be Real the next, and then you're on TikTok, and then the algorithm changes, like it's really hard to build. Be there.
Yeah.
But don't build the franchise on that because you're going to be frustrated.
It's true.
Does that resonate?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I think, you know, as I look at structural changes, a lot of people from a lot of different places are going to want to be a part of what Kerry is doing. And then you begin to think, and this is going to be the same way for churches. If I resonate with your message and you're consistent in it, then I'm going to want to be a part of you, even if you are housed in Chicago, but I live in New York. And that's right. Where we're going
to back to affinity.
Yeah. And that's where we're going to have to figure out how to structure the church with a without a geographical bounded set. And that's where I think micro comes in. So I think digital will lead to micro, and then you have the mega, maybe quarterly or yearly. You know, if you become a worldwide organization, it's like, hey, you know, we're going to do a 3-day conference in this city. You know, if you get really big, maybe you can do a tour. I don't know. But I think that's where we're headed as a church community. And so, yeah, I'm glad you answered the question. We were talking about that a lot. The guys on Digital Church Network and going, hey, where do you see this is going? And I've been there for a while. And you've been doing it for, you know, we've talked about this going on 8 years, 9?
Yeah, what? Yeah. Like, actually, I started writing about 10 years ago, believe it or not, as a
podcast was 14?
Was 8 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
Podcast has been 8 years. And you know what's really interesting, too, is don't despise small beginnings. I mean, we had a good start with the podcast, but if you look at the growth curve, ironically, this is the best year ever for the podcast. Mm. Like, it's kind of going, not well, like hockey stick. Yeah, the first year was good. Second year was a bit better. But I think we're about over 25 million downloads. But
that's awesome.
5 or 6 of those have been in the last year alone. And then 4 more. So if you go back 2 years, we were at 10 million downloads.
That's amazing.
And then 15 come along in the last 2 years. It's like, boom. So, you know, now if we had quit 2 years into it, 5 years into it, given up, But things have a way of building momentum. And all we're trying to do, I mean, you know, we don't even have a growth target for the podcast. We're just trying to bring the best guests and deliver value every single time someone hits play on an episode. And I think if you do that consistently enough, you help a lot of people. You really try to help them. You try to help them spiritually in the church. You try to help them relationally. You help them solve their problems, connect with God. You know, you're not going to have a problem with church. But if it becomes about you or building something, that gets difficult.
Yeah. No, that's so good. I appreciate your time. Definitely. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Chesley. It's been a joy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. If we could, if we want to reach out to you, obviously we've talked a lot about the Art of Leadership Academy. Would you talk a little bit about that before you go?
Yeah, sure. It's a membership site for but mostly church leaders. We do have some entrepreneurs in the house as well, which is great. If you care about the church, you'll probably love it. Maybe you sit on the board or that kind of thing. But it's for senior pastors, executive pastors, student pastors, basically people who have a director role or a lead role at a church. And what we do is all of our premium content is there, courses on preaching and reaching people, evangelism, church growth, like you said, team leadership, et cetera, all the stuff they didn't teach in seminary or in law school. All that's there. We keep adding new courses. We got a new one for 2023 on pastoral succession coming out in January, which we're really excited about. We do monthly team training. And I also do a live monthly coaching call like this and a few hundred leaders. But the heart of it is really the community. And it's just this beautiful thread that shows up every day. People share their heart, what's going on. People pray for each other. We have content posts in there and get some really lively discussions. And because it's troll-free, it feels safe. It feels like these are the people you'd invite for a dinner party. You know what I mean? You know that. Yep. So,
well, I'm actually going to coffee with one of the guys on Thursday. He lives about 15 minutes away from me. I'm like, let's get coffee. So it's good.
That is fantastic. I love that. And we've had so many stories of people who have built friendships and like even jumped on airplanes to go and meet somebody that they've really connected with in the academy. And we see this as a really helpful forum for church leaders who want to make a difference and identify and break their next growth barrier. That's what it's about.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for your time, man. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's the theartofleadershipacademy.com if anyone's interested. So
yes, I'm in there. You get to hang out with me. Obviously, you get to hang out with Carrie, which is a much better sell. But yeah, we hope to see you in there.
Thanks, Chesley.